Welcome back to Farm Foundations. I'm Tyler. I'm here with my other co-hosts, Bo and Joe. And today we're going to dive into our first book review episode. The book we chose for this week is called The Bold Return to Giving a Damn by author Will Harris.
This book combines memoir and manifesto, chronicling Will Harris's transformation of white oak pastures into a model of regenerative agriculture.
Before we dive into our discussion, we'll provide a quick overview of the book. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's take a look back at what we've got accomplished this week.
All right. To start off our weekend review, Bo, do you want to take a stab at it?
Yeah. So the quail are laying eggs like crazy. We kind of rushed over here today, but I have a pint of pickled quail's eggs that I'll be bringing over next week for us to eat on.
Okay.
I ordered the quail egg peeler that Jesse had in her video that I saw, and I was like, I gotta have it. I don't care if it's $1,000, because I don't know, for people that haven't peeled quail eggs, it sucks. It is awful peeling quail eggs. So we ordered that, and then we have just really been working in the garden. The garden started growing heavy, so we've been trellising, and after Joe came over and gave us a little info on pruning tomato plants. I took my first real stab at that and got those pruned up after they set some tomatoes. So that's been our week.
What about your freeze dryer? I know you got it in and finally got it set up, and you've done a little bit of experimentation with that. How's that been going?
I can't believe I forgot about the freeze dryer. My wife's gonna kill me. So I think my favorite so far, you know, we threw up a post, I believe last week, we did 48 eggs in one load of the freeze dryer. So
wow.
We've got those in pint jars now with oxygen absorbers in them. They're in the pantry. We did a bunch of fruit yesterday, so that came out last night, and fruit's really good. And then we're still doing a bunch of candy because Chloe and all her friends just want candy. So
how are the eggs? Did you rehydrate any and
we
cook with them
yet? No, we're probably going to do that pretty quickly so we can make sure that we like them and we can deal with them like that, because the chickens are laying tons of eggs too now, so we need a good way to preserve all those.
Well, that's definitely some exciting progress on your front. Joe, what about you? What have you been up to this week?
Oh, not a lot. Trying to keep lawnmowers running for the most part. It seems like every time I get ready to take a stab at yard work, I get kicked in the shins. Weed eaters down, blowers down, my push mowers down, both riding mowers down. It sucks, but I did get a few things accomplished. Cleaned up the show cow's stall, and that left me with an awful lot of urine and feces rich shavings that we built a new compost bin and got that going. Spent some time on a brush hog that did not break. Finished up in the greenhouse, got the last of it out. I think maybe there's another two dozen green peppers in there that are needing to go to another neighbor's farm. But other than that, the greenhouse is completely empty. Added a bike trailer to my bicycle so that now I can haul more trash down and hopefully more produce back up from the south farm. Hatched out. We had another hatch of baby guineas this week, so I had to move from some birds from the brooder. That was both good and bad. We had a half a dozen birds, and then first night I killed three of them. So we lost a few guineas, but we also hatched out a few more. So I think right now we're at break even in the guinea world. Planted tomatoes. I think I have 96 tomatoes in the ground, and started trellising those last night. So that was kind of exciting. And then we had a lot of rain, kind of in and out. We had some showers that's allowed us to get in the garden and then not and get back in. So I think I understand why your garden took off, Bo, because it is that time of year.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it for this week.
For me, I've been working just quite a bit more than I have been, so I haven't had a whole lot of time to do a whole lot. I did see some exciting things last night. We talked a while back about my Black Soldier fly farm, and I really hadn't done a whole lot with that other than get it started and get it underneath my porch where it kind of hides out. But last night I was working on the porch on some podcast stuff and some other things, and I noticed my first Black Soldier flies flying around.
All right.
Got some mature flies flying around, so that's doing well. And then I think think I found this week maybe a commercial freezer that I'm hoping that I'll be able to get a hold of. That way we can build another smoker. For you guys listening, if you don't know, Joe's got a big smoker that he's built out of an old refrigeration unit or an old refrigerator. And that thing is just the cat's ass when it comes to smoking. So I'm hoping to get that. That's going to be a project maybe for next week. But those are my two big things that we've got going this week.
That's a good piece of news for sure.
That'll be definitely helpful when we go to smoking chickens or doing whatever. I have a lot more room to do that. All right. Well, that kind of wraps up our week in review. Before we get too deep here, Bo, do you just want to take our listeners through this book review we've got here on The Bold Return to Giving a Damn?
Yeah. So for starters, awesome book. Everybody that is into homesteading should read this. But for a quick overview, The Bold Return to Giving a Damn by Will Harris tells the compelling story of how a fourth-generation cattleman took a giant leap from the industrial agricultural practices he was raised with to embrace regenerative farming. Will Harris transformed his family's conventional farm, White Oak Pastures, into a regenerative agricultural powerhouse. This change involved not only a shift in farming techniques, but also a
philosophical
shift, emphasizing the health of the soil, ethical treatment of animals, and the well-being of his community. Harris's journey, filled with challenges and triumphs, offers a blueprint for others looking to make sustainable and ethical changes in agriculture.
I know Will Harris is kind of new to me, and I think you as well, Bo, but he's been a pretty formative guy in Joe's journey and homesteading and along his homesteading journey, and I'm really glad he introduced us to this book. It's really a game changer. He's got a lot of values that kind of align with some of the things that we've been talking about this whole time. So to get us started in our first segment here, we just want to do an introduction to Will Harris, and we want to talk about his journey. Joe, do you want to talk a little bit about how you found out about this guy, and tell us a little bit more about Mr. Harris?
Well, Will Harris is among maybe a half a dozen, let's call them movers and shakers, people that have influenced regenerative farming and a different way of farming, different way of raising food. And you've heard us talk all the time about making food great again, a play on the MAGA hats. I think we need to be more concerned about making food great again. And Will Harris and Joel Salatin, Greg Judy, and the likes have been focused on making food great again, at least as far back as I can remember. Now, that being said, I've been into this lifestyle my whole life, and I've just sort of gravitated towards these guys. Now that we have the internet and we have social media, the algorithm sort of force them upon us. So I think I really started learning about Will Harris, and I first found out about his book when I popped open Audible and said, geez, what do I need to listen to? I've got a long day on the tractor. What do I need to listen to? And it just sort of pops up. So, I mean, if you're into this and you're using your cell phone to learn and to grow versus your library card, it doesn't take you very long to find out who these players are. And Will Harris is certainly, I'd like to take my hat off to him and shake his hand someday, because he certainly has done an awful lot to move the needle in things that I think are important. But that being said, Will Harris is a fourth generation farmer. He has shifted his inherited farm from conventional agriculture or dependency on chemical fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, and tillage into one that uses none of those things. So that's a huge step. In fact, that's the name of his book. That's the bold step that he talks about in the title of his book. It talks about his initial motivations and challenges, and I think he'll tell you, he'll be the first to tell you, much like Gabe Brown, that he was going broke, that it was not working. And we see that here in our own neighborhood here in Southwest Missouri. Many of the farmers I know are struggling, and I had a cocktail or an adult beverage with one of my neighbors here recently, and he said, Joe, conventional agriculture has failed me. I think it's important, though, that we realize that most farmers feel that they have failed commercial agriculture. And that's part of the what makes Will's step away from commercial agriculture so bold, is that it's something that we've been taught at land grant colleges. We've been taught at the barbershop. We've been taught by our grandfathers and our fathers that, you know, when you want something to work, you dump some more chemicals on it, you kill it, and you force the plants that you do want to grow, outcompete the bad ones, so to speak. But Will was very bold in saying there's no bad ones. So I was excited to hear that. And then it also touches on his approach and how he redefines farming and his concept of radical traditional farming. And I like to, I've said this in my own words since I was a child, but I like to remind folks that, and maybe we've done it on this podcast already, that farming once upon a time was a man who or a family that grew what they needed and sold their surplus. Today, that's quite the opposite. Most farmers, in fact, harvest is going on today as we speak across the street from us. Most farmers grow one or two commodities and they buy everything else. So by the old definition, they're not farmers. They're just, you know, chess players. They're moving their pieces across the field is all they're really doing. And I don't mean to take away from those guys, but they've been taught and taught and taught that the only way you can do this is through bigger and larger equipment that's and shave off a point here and a point there on efficiencies. But the fact of the matter is they'll never succeed long term as long as they continue to get up in the morning and say, geez, what do we need to kill? And that's the opposite of what a farmer is. So hats off to Will Harris for doing a great job pointing out what a farmer should be, and that's radically traditional.
I think it's cool to look back at the history of his farm and how he's kind of changed tune over the years. I think White Oak Pastures, we were looking at their website just a minute ago, dates back to the mid to late 1800s.
1866.
And for him to come in and, you know, he spent a good portion of his life in conventional farming. I think we found, what was it, 1995, that he's taken this bold step and kind of switched over. So he's got quite a bit of experience in that regenerative arena, about, what, 30 years, pretty close to. But to take somebody that has this family legacy of conventional agriculture and for them to change their mind, I think that's really notable and really important to understand that, you know, as humans, we don't like change, but if this guy can make that change, then certainly I can and you can as well.
He must have a massive set of cojones.
Probably got a wheelbarrow he hauls around, for sure.
I guess so.
So now that we've got a little bit of history on Will, let's dive into our next segment here. We're just going to talk a little bit about the book, some of the themes and concepts that he talks about, and what differentiates White Oak Pastures from conventional agriculture. Bo, do you want to take a stab here and talk a little bit about some of the environmental impact of farming practices and some of the differences that they see on their farm?
So I think, you know, Joe touched on the fact that he was going broke whenever he decided to make this change. But I also think another thing that he realized was that his land was sick. It was not well. He wasn't seeing the grass production that they had, you know, decades before that. And I think there's the thing that Will had in his favor was he had four generations on, you know, basically the same land, where, you know, me, you know, the home that I'm at right now, I only know it for 2 years. So I'm sure Will had memories, you know, back in the 50s and 60s of what the land looked like. There's probably pictures, you know, the old timey pictures of different places on the land. And I think, you know, he had enough foresight and hindsight put together looking at some of those things to just know that what he was doing, what he had been taught by his father and what his grandfather had at least somewhat taught his father, was killing his land and was hurting his animals and probably really hurting his family to some point. So I think his shift from what we're calling conventional farming to regenerative you know, he only had cattle on the place, I believe, you know, for the entire time. I believe that's all his father ever had. And he's, you know, changed that to chickens and sheep. I think he still said he hates goats, which I'm sure brought a tear to Joe's eye. I believe there are a few times he still hasn't figured out a way to get along with goats. But he brought all of this other, all these other animals into that land to help care for it. And I think that was one of the big steps that he took.
I think we've got this age-old wisdom that we shouldn't put all our eggs in one basket. We think about conventional agriculture today. They've kind of thrown that out the window and said, you know, we've got to go monoculture. If you're going to raise cattle, raise only cattle. If you're going to raise chickens, raise only chickens.
If you're going to grow corn, that's all we grow. I mean, they... Yeah, you're right.
On the grand scale, that works because, you know, I say that works. You know, as a nation, if you're raising corn and you destroy your land and you have a bad year on corn, not everybody's in that same spot. So we might survive at least a little bit longer. We can prolong that a little bit if you have a bad year. But as a farmer, as an individual, when you've destroyed your land and you can't grow corn anymore, that's devastating to you as an individual. And I think he's kind of figured that out. When we talk about farms going broke, how many dairies have we seen close around here? Because there's just no money in dairy cattle anymore for the individual farmer. We can produce a shitload of milk on a commercial operation where we've got thousands of cows. Doesn't matter if a cow gets sick, but when you've got a small herd and you're producing that better quality.
Tyler, I'd like to push back on you that though. I think you may have missed a little point there somewhere in the book, but I think what Will teaches us specifically is that it doesn't work on a grand scheme. Moreover, it's causing, on a global scale, it's causing a wreck that we may not be able to undo.
When I say that, I may have misspoke a little bit there. So I'm not saying that it works on a grand scheme. I'm saying you can push that problem down the road a little bit.
That's true.
Yeah. And the system can bear it for a little bit. You can push that problem off on the next generation. But when all these individual farms close up, eventually we're going to run out of people that have sustainable land that they can produce on.
Yeah, I was recently I guess that's in southern Utah, right along the interstate there. There's the biggest dairy farm I've ever seen in my life. And driving north on that interstate system, you notice nothing but alfalfa trucks. Big, giant, flatbed semis hauling alfalfa. One after another. There's 10 alfalfa trucks for every one automobile. And every one of those was pulling into that dairy farm. And it frightens me that we have to drive alfalfa. I mean, there wasn't a blade of grass anywhere. It's the middle of the damn desert. Wasn't a blade of grass anywhere. The cows never saw the light of day. I mean, they were completely indoors. It's too damn hot to grow a cow out there, but they had them in inside environment with food being trucked to them. And it occurred to me, what would happen to milk prices if one or two of those giant dairy barns got a disease or caught fire? You know, if there was some sort of catastrophic event, I don't think our nation can afford that kind of risk. And sadly, that's where we've gotten to, is that, you know, our eggs, we saw $7, well, it's not been that long ago, we saw $7 per dozen eggs over less than 12% of our eggs being, of our birds being killed through avian influenza. You know, it's dangerous. And still, the egg industry has not recovered from that. It's not fully recovered. It caused a ripple that's we're still dealing with today. There's more egg now than we need, but that's because everybody started putting more birds on the ground. But we can't afford to continue with these non-sustainable practices. You can't truck alfalfa to cows.
I think the writing's on the wall, and a couple of years ago, we saw the COVID crisis, and I know that's hotly debated. We don't want to get too much into that, but how many disruptions did we see to our supply chains because of that? And when we rely, you know, a ship gets stuck in the Suez Canal, we're still recovering from that. Bo, you could probably speak to that better than anybody in the trucking industry. You know, when we rely on food miles to make the difference, any kind of disruption like that really is crippling to us. And we're still feeling those effects. So if we don't pay attention to the writing on the wall and change our ways, I think think we're going to continue to see these issues arise.
I think you're right, Tyler. We are on a slippery slope, to say the least.
So as we think about some of those things, what are some of the specific practices that Harris adopted, some of the things that we've learned about in the book, some of the ways that we can alleviate some of these concerns?
Well, first of all, I'll say for my own farm, I've maintained since I was a young guy. Again, I will remind the listeners that I started at this when I was 12, and that every bit of soil health starts when we stop looking at soil as with a myopic lens. We need to understand that soil is an ecosystem or a biome in and of itself. And if when we build on that, every single part of the farm therein becomes an ecosystem and a biome. So let's and someone once told me there's more living organisms in a shovel full of dirt than there is people on the or animals on the entire planet. So to me, that's mind-boggling. Every shovel of soil is teeming with life. That's bacteria and mycorrhizal fungi. That tells us that the soil is, you know, I like to think of Horton Hears a Who, you know, the little tiny speck of dust, all these things happening. And that's what we have in our soil. And then when we step back and look at it with a bigger lens, now we look at, you know, the soil should move to our grasses. You know, what's growing on that? Grass would be the first thing. That in and of itself should be very diverse and complex. And then we step back and say, well, the woodlot. And then we say the animals that are grazing on that grass or the animals that are browsing on that woodlot. You know, none of those secondary or, you know, as we step away, none of those other ecosystems can flourish if the soil is not taken care of first. And so I think Will's first aha moment, and I've listened to his book and read it, I think his first aha is when he did realize his soil was sick and that he needed to right the wrongs of multi-generational misuse and miseducation from our land-grant colleges. For me, that was the big takeaway, is that it needs to be, farming should never be looked at as farming, but as a grouping of ecosystems.
What about you, Bo? What specific practices of Harris's kind of stood out for you?
So he talked a lot about looking back, you know, again, back in the 1800s, more than likely, where, you know, buffalo roamed the land and how, you know, so many different animals would touch the same area of grass or soil. And I think he took a lot from that. You know, whenever he started chickens, whenever it was time to butcher those chickens, he was basically just giving those away to his farm hands and stuff because he didn't know what to do with them, but he still knew that chickens were good for the land. And that was, you know, me and Joe have talked a lot about, even if our chickens never laid an egg, we'd still have chickens because they do so many other things for us. And I liked reading that because that kind of reassured me that, you know, the chickens are helping take care of the land. They're not just an egg source or a meat source. You know, they go out and work during the day, which is really cool. You know, they go out, they work all day, and then they feed you at the end of their day, which is, I mean, chickens are just really cool. So,
and I'd like to add to that, Bo, you know, 80% of chicken shit comes out of that bird at night. So even when it's asleep,
It's working.
I'd like to find a couple of hands that work as hard as a chicken.
Yeah.
Chickens are pretty cool creatures. Pretty cool. I think some of the big takeaways for all of us here is just understanding that biodiversity is important. When you look at a piece of ground and it's all fescue and there's a zero biodiversity, or it's all corn and we've sprayed so much Roundup on it to ensure that we've killed everything but the corn, literally the only thing that can survive there is corn. We're really just raping the land at that point, destroying, to Joe's point, the soil, and it's just not sustainable. We can't do it. Another important thing that I've taken away is Harris's commitment to education, and he's not doing this because it's making him rich. I mean, I think he's doing very well with it, but he's got a big focus on educating people, because not only is it important for me to have healthy soil, but it's important for my neighbor to have healthy soil as well. It leads not only to my success, but their success as well. And, you know, we've talked about in previous podcasts, you know, red tides and runoff and soil erosion and really those long-term effects down the stream. When we don't have that biodiversity, we're really compounding those issues. So not only is it important for us to practice these things ourselves, but to educate our community, to work with our community, so we all can have a little bit of success there and see some change.
And I think that's the fundamentals for farm foundations for what we do here every day. That's a good point, Tyler.
So what about, you know, as we talk a little bit more about that, benefits to the environment, what kind of benefits are we seeing to our animals with these practices? And again, local community, like we just mentioned.
Well, I think we've kind of touched on making the soil healthy again, which is helping the environment. I think there's a lot to be said for the oxygen and different things that, you know, the plants on your farm create compared to, you know, something that just robs you of the oxygen and the nutrients. But I still, again, this is something we talk about all the time, but I guarantee you he's got happier animals than he did in 1994. They just can't help but be happier. You know, I mean, the amount of acreage, I don't even remember what the amount of acreage was, but, you know, he talked a lot about how many acres that they had on his farm and adjoining farms and places that they had to drive to take care of cattle and different things. And then, you know, it all came back towards the end of the book to where a solar panel company was coming in to fill up this field full of solar panels, and they were going to make the same mistakes that Will's father had made. You know, they were going to come in and just kill everything so they could put those in. And, you know, Will came in and, you know, sat down with these bigwigs, and I think that's really cool, because I'm sure, you know, these guys were probably suit and tie wearing guys, and, you know, I just picture that Will came in wearing his bib overalls and a cowboy hat and, you know, started, like you said, teaching them and, you know, brought them to his farm to look and say, you know, if you guys really care about the environment with this solar deal, let's do it right. Like, let's do it. Let me graze that and maintain that land for you, so you don't have to use chemicals. And then, being the businessman he is, charge them the same amount that it would have cost them to keep it sprayed and maintained and all that, and got to run his animals on it. So, you know, I think that had some huge environmental stuff, because, I mean, there's so much out there that, you know, just like the solar panels, you know, they say we're all about, you know, treating the environment better and finding new, you know, ways to provide people with electricity, but then they were just going to go in and kill everything there to start with and damage the planet. So I think Will's got some really cool takes on some of that.
I think, you know, as we talk a little bit about animals, one of the things, I think it was actually just before that particular part of the book, he talked about grain-fed cattle on a feedlot and how much we're overfeeding them and just loading them with carbs and trying to get them as fat as possible. And I think the statement was something along the lines of, when you take a steer, you put it on a feedlot, you shove all this grain and carbohydrates down its throat, and then you butcher it early. When you look at that animal right before butcher, that is the equivalent of looking at a 16-year-old kid that weighs 400 pounds. And when we talk about the health of our animals, you know, if you saw a 16-year-old kid that weighs 400 pounds,
you slap his mother.
You can't help but be concerned about their health, and we think it's perfectly acceptable to do this to our livestock. When we think about the health of that animal, but not only the health of that animal, but the nutritional value of the end product that comes from that animal. When you take an animal that is that obese, that poorly cared for, and you're going to consume that at the end of the day, how comfortable are you consuming that beef? I mean, really, is it giving us the nutrition that we need? Or is it just filling our stomachs and pushing that problem down the road like we talked about earlier?
You know, since we're talking about cattle, and I have traveled this great nation a number of times, it's interesting to talk cows with people from different regions. And when you get to discussing carcass quality in particular, a Western cattle producer doesn't particularly care for Eastern produced cattle in that the grass has got more moisture in it and less nutrients. And therefore the beef has then subsequently is more moisture. You know, you can grow a cow easier on tall grass in the East than you can on short grass in the West. But the guys out West claim that their beef tastes better. And the word they use is washy. If the grass is washy, the cow will be washy. And then I think that the people will be washy. So, you know, it's interesting. You see a 400-pound 16-year-old kid that may be dying from the very same conditions that will eventually kill that steer or keep that grass from being nutritionally complete. So, you know, it starts at the very basis. Healthy soil makes healthy grass, a healthy cow, healthy cow. Maybe not a 400-pound 16-year-old, but certainly that child should be healthier at 16 than what he is at 400 pounds. We can't always say that that's a, you know, there's not a medical issue there or something, but obesity is certainly a bigger problem in the U.S. now than it ever has been. And I like to think it's because our cattle are now washy.
Things like that, you know, coming from the healthcare and industry, obesity is one of the, we're going to go top 10 just to be safe, one of the top 10 causes of death in the United States. I mean, obesity is killing our nation. We know without question that that is a horrible, horrible thing for us to just turn a blind eye and say, in the livestock, it doesn't matter. It's awfully arrogant and awfully ignorant of us.
So there's when you've asked us to talk about the benefits of Will's processes to the environment, the animals, and local community, I think that's the most important one. He's making food great again. You know, we got bigger things to worry about than making politics great again. We got to worry about the health of our children, and it starts with regenerative practices like Will Harris.
I think it's important for us to get back to the basics. We think about, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, water, shelter. That's kind of the foundation of what we need. So if we're not taking care of those things adequately and appropriately, really, we don't have anything to build on. So it is super important. One of the things you touched on, Joe, traveling the country and getting different opinions is a good segue into our next segment here. We want to talk about personal and community impact. When you talk about different opinions, I remember back when I was in high school in FFA, I did dairy cattle judging, and my parents kind of laughed at me, and I kind of laughed because my ag teacher said, hey, you'd be really good at dairy cattle judging. At the time, had never set foot on a dairy farm. My ag teacher told me that not only was that not a bad thing, but it was really a great benefit to me because I didn't have bias. I didn't have generational influence that told me that I liked my cow this way or that away. I could take really a neutral, unbiased approach to judging those dairy cattle. One of the cool things that I liked about Will was that he works a lot with people that don't have a whole lot of farming experience, and he brings in a lot of different perspectives. So as we talk about personal and community impact, I think involving people that don't necessarily have a background in conventional agriculture, they don't have those biases, helping to educate them and helping to bring them into the lifestyle goes a long way, not only for that individual person and bettering them, but for bettering us, because we get different and unbiased perspectives. That was a really cool thing that I saw. Bo, what about you? What were some things that stuck out about Will's approach to personal and community impact?
So he kind of took you on a drive on how to get to his farm and talked about the nearest neighboring town and how it was basically a ghost town, you know, back in the day, you know. And I think, and if I get this number right, I should get a gold star, but I think he now employs like 265 people or something like that. Like, it's in the hundreds of people that he employs. And, you know, part of that has brought that entire town back to life. You know, people have moved into homes, bought homes, built homes, whatever, open stores, you know, different things are going on there. And I think, you know, he's had a huge impact on his community in that form. But then personally, I mean, he was really good at just taking a big chance at stuff. You know, I talked about him in the beginning. He was outsourcing the butchering of his cattle, and that wasn't working. He kind of found like a conglomerate type deal where some guys were going to go in together and buy this butcher deal so they could all get their stuff butchered. And he basically thought they were all idiots because they had no idea what it was actually going to take. And then just decided, I'm just going to have to do it myself. Like, if I really want this done right, I'm just going to have to do it myself. So for him personally, you know, I mean, he has created, and I hate to use the word empire, but I mean, it for that little area of the world and from where he's went just in the past 30 years, I mean, he's really built an empire on something that in 1995, every single neighbor that he had down there was probably talking about him behind his back and thought he was the biggest idiot that had ever lived, coming from being, you know, even before that, I mean, he was a very renowned cattleman. Like, it wasn't like, you know, Bo Prock just decided to do this one day. Like, he had generational success as a cattleman and decided to make a change. Now, again, it wasn't going well at the time, and his land was sick, but
there was still barbershop talk going on, you can bet.
Yeah, he probably could have pushed that problem all down the road to his kids, like we talked about earlier, and died as a successful cattleman. So to take the leap that he took, and then to continue taking leaps, you know, on down the road, and I mean, we were looking at his website before the podcast started today, and just looking at all the stuff that the book didn't even touch on that he's doing and offering and stuff, it's amazing.
I think one of my favorite quotes from the book, and I really hope I get this right, was the sun doesn't shine on the same dog's ass all the time. Either the dog will move or the sun will move. So as we try and make these changes and we make this impact, you know, even this guy that was super successful, he didn't always have the sunshine on his ass. There are failures. There are struggles. It's not always going to go well, but if you can stick it out and you can make it through those struggles, if you can be innovative and find solutions to those issues, you can get through and you can see some success. Joe, what about you? What about some of the personal and community impact? What are some big things that stuck out to you from that aspect?
Well, I would have to agree with both of you in that when you look at it, and by the way, we come from this little town, this podcast comes from a town of about 1,100 to 1,200 people.
1,116, or we have 8 move away.
Very small town, and it kind of depends seasonally. I think we get a little flush of people, but we have very little to offer here. There's almost no employment. You know, we have a Dollar General and a feed store. It's really about and an auto parts store. It's really about our only places of trade. So when we can do something that will bring us back to business model that requires more labor. More labor requires more laborers require more support, and eventually you've got a town. And I'll illustrate this by saying, guys, if you leave our little town of Purdy, Missouri, and drive to Kansas, the further west you go in Kansas, the more desolate the little towns become. And that's because a combine, a single operator in a combine, does the work of 30 men and 60 horses. You know, a couple of generations back, those towns existed, and those towns had auto dealerships. I was shocked to learn that at one point, Purdy, Missouri had the largest hardware store west of the Mississippi. We had 4 automobile dealerships in Purdy, Missouri. We had one of the largest rail sidings for cattle sales and a massive strawberry auction, as well as a tomato cannery. All in Purdy, Missouri. But as agriculture has changed and became the what I call the land giants, fewer people are needed and the towns just dry up. Schools get consolidated and folks leave. And I think when it's imperative for us, if we want to keep our towns alive, if we want to have a football team, we got to have a reason for kids, for parents to want to live here. You can have a great school, you can hire great teachers, but if there's nothing further for students' parents to do, there's not going to be a football team. And there's countless number of towns as we go west from here that show, in my mind, in my estimation, that show exactly like Bluffton, Georgia, where Will Harris is from. So again, I think it's needed for our culture as well as for our children's health and well-being. It's part of our culture. Rural America is dying, guys, dying fast. And we can't continue on the same path and expect the same results.
I think it's important to also note that when we look back on that history, you know, you talk about the history of Purdy. I'm the youngest one in the room. And we think about that and we think, oh yeah, back in the good old, you know, back in the 1800s, Purdy was this booming metropolis. That's two generations ago. That was my grandma's. My grandma was growing up. She remembers the tomato cannery. She remembers picking tomatoes as a kid. We're not that. This is a recent thing. We're not that far removed from it. I think that's a scary thing, because when people my age think about that, they think, oh, that was eons ago. That's not going to happen to us. No, that's happening.
That did happen to us.
We're actively experiencing it now.
Yes, sir. Well said.
One of the, when we talk about personal things, one of the favorite stories me and Joe were talking about the other day in Will Harris's Butcher Room, and it talks about it in the book. They were listening to a bunch of loud music, and I think it... I can't remember all the details of that story, but can somebody touch on that a little bit? And the conversation that he had, I believe, was with his daughter about, hey, not interfere with the workers and make sure that they have a good place to work and that they're taken care of as well.
So the best I remember, and Joe, you'll have to help me with some of this, but whoever it was, daughter or something like that, I think it was a daughter that had came back to help with
stuff. Yeah, Jeannie, I believe.
Was tired of all the loud music. And Will basically, you know, told her that loud music is why they were, you know, cutting so many beefs a day and to leave a beat. And it was just kind of neat that he accepted that. Because I think he even went on to say, you know, that he despised the music that was playing. Like, he didn't like it. It wasn't his kind of jam. But it made his workers happy and made his workers productive.
I think that's an important thing to think about as well. When we think about this lifestyle, I think sometimes we can get a little bit too focused on, you know, taking care of our animals, taking care of our land, taking care of our livestock, but we've got to take care of our people as well. And when we do all of those things together, we end up with a great community of people that are happy to go to work, people that are happy to contribute. But when we start neglecting any one part of this puzzle, we're going to end up with unhappy workers, we're going to end up with unhappy animals, and we're going to end up with unhealthy ground.
Total failure.
And then we're unhappy. And, yeah.
And you guys have heard me say this on a number of occasions. I'll say it in my grave. You can carve it on my headstone. But some little elves don't want to make toys. And we call this farm the Island of Misfit Toys. I find that diversity at the dinner table makes conversation far more interesting. Diversity in everything that we do makes our lives better. And for Will Harris to say, let's play some music that I may not like and let's allow our people be happy is a great deal to do with why they've been successful.
All right. So as we move on, we're going to jump into our final segment here and just talk about some of our final thoughts and takeaways about this book. I don't care who wants to jump in first, but who wants to share some of their final thoughts about the book overall and about how we can apply it on our homesteads?
Well, I've got two things that I've been saying for years, and I was always afraid on how to say them. I knew how I felt, but, you know, sometimes we throttle back our own feelings so we can tell our story without being offensive. And I think we could tell that about old Army stories. We could tell that about hunting stories, the big fish story. You know, you might have seen an 18-foot bass in the family farm pond, but you would never own up to it. You might say, saw a pretty good fish. You know, you wouldn't be as outlandish around a table of strangers as you normally would. But Will Harris said it best in a couple of different things. The first one he said was, putting chemicals on the ground is like pissing in your pants. He said, pissing in your pants to stay warm. He said, sounds like a good idea and feels really good in the beginning, but overall it's not very sustainable. And I think that's really, I don't know if we call that eloquent, but in Joe Grissom's world, that's the coolest message ever. Putting chemicals on your ground is like pissing in your pants to stay warm. Not a long-term solution. And then Will goes on to say, and this is the one that I would throttle back on, but these two gentlemen at the table with me know me well enough to know that my experience in the Army left me speaking blunt and frank. And Will Harris says, when we talk about labels, it is so fucked up, it's beyond belief. And we had a term in the Army that says FUBAR, and that's fucked up beyond recognition. And I applaud him for taking the bold steps to say those words out loud and not care about the ramifications that may come from sitting around a table of unlike-minded people. So I was certainly vulcanized in my feelings, and I don't want to say radicalized, but I certainly appreciate the statements made by Will Harris in those two in particular.
But what about you? What are final thoughts, takeaways?
So I think one of my biggest takeaways was that you shouldn't ever be scared to take a step back and look at things. Again, this is a four-generation guy that, so, you know, the very first generation that was there probably farmed a lot like he does today. The second generation probably saw the industrialization of farming. Chemicals come in. His father probably took all of the principles that his daddy passed down to him and probably started feedlot type cattle, Joe. Would that be accurate with his daddy?
Yep.
And then, you know, for him to get to 95, not a young man. I think we figured that he's about 70 now, so he would have been 40 at the time he made that decision, my age. And to take a step back from everything he knew. And I think that's huge. Everything he knew, he was getting ready to go against. Everything he had been taught. Everything he learned in college. Everything that, his wife probably told him he was crazy. His kids probably told him he was crazy. But he took a step back, took a deep breath, and looked at everything and said, we're going to make a change. And it was a huge change. I mean, he didn't just decide that, hey, we're going to do 5-strand barbed wire instead of 4 from now on. I mean, he changed his entire farm for the better. And So, after reading the book, one of the first things I did was just go walk around my fields and just look. I sat down in my sheep field for a little bit and just looked around, looked at the grasses that were growing, and I think that's a huge takeaway for everybody is don't just rush out and do your chores and rush back in. You know, actually take a look around at stuff and see if something needs to change or needs to be done different.
So. If you don't feel good about what you see on your own farm, you're wasting your time and ruining your animals.
Kind of the last line we've got on our slide here is thoughts about how traditional methods can be revolutionary when applied sustainably. And I think, coming out of this book for me, one of my big takeaways is that problems are rife with opportunity if we just look at them through the right lens. Bo mentioned the story about the solar farm and the sheep. And I think that's a perfect example of that thought process, because I think solar technology is revolutionary. I think it's a step that we need to go.
Absolutely.
But when, the suits come in and they say, hey, we're going to put in a solar farm, they're going to look at problems and they're going to look for a quick and easy solution. They're not going to look for an opportunity there on their own, unprompted. So they're going to go in, they're going to start spraying, and they're going to start destroying the land. They had a problem. They've got a solution. It's not a sustainable one. So if we take those problems and we look for an opportunity there, like Will Harris did, and we say, hey, you know what, instead of dumping all this chemical on this ground to kill off all the grass and paying a landscape company to come mow and waste all of the carbon and nutritional value that is in that grass, why don't I come in, I'll put some sheep in, you can pay me no more than what you're paying the landscape guys, no more than what you're spending on chemical, but I've got an opportunity and now I've got a product and I can raise these sheep and we're both successful. I think for me, that was a big takeaway.
And you guys, raising sheep in what we call marginal grounds, sheep and goats is a system that works globally. Every other country I've ever visited raises sheep in marginal areas, airport runways, road ditches, playgrounds, cemeteries. And I had a dear friend of mine that grew up in New Orleans grazing sheep in the cemeteries. They didn't have crews of people in there. There was not lawnmowers or, you know, 60-inch Husqvarna zero-turn mowers knocking over tombstones. They had sheep. And when they got to the oldest part, he told me they ran small sheep to make sure that they weren't bumping over headstones of any kind. And now we've got away from that. You know, now if you go to the cemetery, you very seldom see a sheep in a cemetery. What happened? Why are we paying these road workers hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to mow our right-of-ways? Why don't we have sheep in there? Will Harris, you did a good job.
I definitely enjoy his book. I think I can speak for all of us and say that it was definitely a great read. Definitely has given us all a lot to think about.
I'd like to challenge our listeners, if any of you want to buy his book and you don't take something of value away from it, call me. I'll double your money back.
All right. Well, I think that wraps us up today. We want to thank everybody for joining us for our discussion about the bold return to giving a damn. We hope that maybe some of our thoughts on it have inspired you to think differently about agriculture and sustainability. More importantly, we hope Will Harris maybe can inspire you too. If you haven't read it, please go pick up a copy and give it a read.
And don't forget to check out Will Harris's book if you haven't already. It's a must read for anyone interested in the future of farming.
And stay tuned for our next episode where we'll continue to explore innovative and sustainable farming practices. Until then, happy homesteading.
And before we close up, we want to make sure that you are all encouraged. We would love to have you follow us on social media for more updates, some of the behind-the-scenes take on our daily lives. If you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review, share it with your friends. And of course, as always, if you have any questions, call us, write us, reach out, come visit the farm. We would love to have you.